Hey, well, hello, good afternoon. I'm Mary Dixon, and I study phosphate mobilization in tomatoes at the University of Florida. And today I will be discussing with you about how to use artificial soil solutions to identify phosphorus-efficient genotypes from tomato germplasm. So this topic is pretty significant because the sustainable use of phosphorus is a major concern of modern society. First and foremost, it's a non-renewable resource. Phosphorus is mined from phosphate rock, which forms over hundreds of millions of years. So we can't exactly make more rock, you know. Because we're mining so much, too, the resources aren't just depleting in quantity, but they're depleting in quality as well. Lots of soils are limiting in phosphorus because they exist in low concentrations in the soil, as low as, like, 2 micromolar in the soil solution. However, a lot of cropping systems have incredibly high amounts of phosphorus, but they're still not available whatsoever because the form that it exists in is not a bioavailable form. This is because the naturally occurring form of phosphorus is orthophosphate, a negative ion which readily binds to certain cations like calcium and renders it unavailable, binds it to just insoluble complexes. So it gets fixed in the soil, and these reactions actually happen so readily and so commonly that only about 10% of the phosphorus in applied fertilizer actually makes it up inside the plant. So growers tend to compensate for this by over-fertilizing, and this leads to concerns, which you guys can, you know, imagine, primarily eutrophication. The main driver of eutrophication is runoff from phosphate. And that it leads to just a bunch of detrimental harm to marine ecosystems and waterways. And even though there's all these concerns around phosphorus, it is a super important element. It is absolutely essential for all life on Earth. It's the second most demanded nutrient by plants, right behind nitrogen. Plants need it to survive. If they don't have it, some classic deficiency symptoms are stunted growth and the purple coloration on the adaxial surface of old growth due to anthocyanin accumulation. Now, I study phosphorus relations in tomatoes because tomatoes are super important and high-value crops, especially in Florida, which is where I'm from and study. In Florida, tomatoes are the most horticulturally important vegetable that we have and grow. They're also just pretty, you know, good plants to study because they're day neutral, really fast growing. They got many recognizable heritable characteristics and produce a whole bunch of seeds. So they're just kind of overall good plants. And Florida has a bunch of factors in play, too, because there's a bunch of severe weather stresses, lots of sandy soil, urban sprawl, and lots of pest pressure. So it's a good place to study all these interactions because those can exacerbate some of the issues related with phosphorus. So what I was pretty much hoping to accomplish with my studies is to establish this artificial soil solution that is suitable for identifying certain genotypes that are elite in phosphorus use efficiency. Additionally, I wanted to look at the relations of calcium and EDTA, how they react with tomatoes in regards to phosphorus use efficiency in this solution. Calcium and EDTA are components that can alter this like solution equilibria, which I'll go into more detail in a little bit, but that's the motivation for those two. And what I expected to see was that there would be a clear outcome with this hydroponic solution, like it would be able to identify these elite genotypes. I expected to see genotypic difference, and I expected to see the typical phosphate starvation responses that plants employ, such as rhizosphere acidification. What this slide shows is pretty much just like a comparison between my hydroponic solution and a regular soil solution. And so you can notice that even though the regular phosphorus concentration and the diffusion constants are much higher in a hydroponic solution than in a soil solution, there is no buffering capacity. What my hydroponic solution attempts to do is mimic the heterogeneous phosphorus distribution that soils have. So the form of sparingly soluble phosphate that I chose to study is tricalcium phosphate. It has a solubility constant Ksp of 2.07 times 10 to the negative 33, which pretty much means it's just as sparsely soluble as you can get. It's pretty insoluble. So, and as like a kind of quick chemistry review, QSP, the iron product, when that's higher than Ksp, precipitate, i.e. the tricalcium phosphate forms. And when it's the other way around, when it's lower than Ksp, those dissociated ions on the other side of the equation are the more predominant form. And like I mentioned before, calcium and EDTA alter this equilibria. When calcium is added, this equation shifts far more to the left here. So, yeah, left. Which renders the unavailable tricalcium phosphate to be the predominant form. It's more, it exists more than the dissociated ions. And the exact opposite happens when you add EDTA. EDTA is a chelating agent, and all that means is it is a certain chemical compound that binds to metal ions and forms stable water-soluble complexes. And this, like I said, does the opposite effect. It shifts it to the right. So the predominant elements here would be those dissociated ions of calcium and phosphate as opposed to the tricalcium phosphate, the unavailable form. So that is that. And what I did to just kind of go about doing this, like the step-by-step procedure here, was just germinating a whole bunch of seeds of Cherokee green and the Japanese black trifle. Those are the two cultivars I studied in rock wool in a hoop house at UF for about a week. They grew up until about the shoot measured like 2 centimeters or so, at which time I planted it in my modified Hoagland solution. And they grew in these 1 liter opaque jars with these green foam caps to prevent light entry. And I didn't have any type of air pump system or air stones, so in order to avoid anoxic conditions, I added hydrogen peroxide periodically. And they grew here for about 3 weeks. And during that time, I measured the pH of the solution. And after the three-week period, I harvested the plants, took the height, separated the roots from the shoots and dried them, and then measured the biomass accumulation and did my data analysis. And just kind of like review of the different treatments that I did. There were 6 treatments, 4 replicates per treatment, and 2 cultivars studied, so there are 48 plants total. There was the absolute true control of just completely soluble phosphorus source for the plants, so they weren't starved of any nutrients. And then tricalcium phosphate was the phosphorus source for the rest of the treatments. One treatment just had that without any other, like as its default equilibrium, like there wasn't anything added to it. Then there are 2 treatments for 2 different concentrations of calcium, and then 2 treatments with 2 different concentrations of EDTA added. And it's kind of cool. These photos are just indicative samples for each treatment. And if you look in that bottom right-hand corner there, those are the calcium treatments, and they're really short. So, like, observationally, you can see that, and then you'll see it graphically in a couple slides. So acidification of the rhizosphere is a very classic phosphorus deficiency coping mechanism. It helps to release the phosphorus that is bound in those, like the tricalcium phosphate, those complexes. And you can very easily see that this solution helped to show this. There was no genotypic difference. The graph on the left is the Cherokee green, the graph on the right is Japanese black trifle. But there was very clear treatment difference. So the red line at the top, you can see, did not change in pH that much, and that's because it didn't have to. That was a soluble phosphorus solution. It wasn't starved of nutrients. It didn't really have to do anything. It just kind of happily grew as is. Whereas if you look at the bottom, that purple line, that's the highest level of calcium added. That was where there was just no phosphorus. The plants were really struggling, so they had to acidify the rhizosphere. They had to cope with this. And so that's what you can see from these graphs. Also, stunted growth is a classic deficiency symptom. And again, this is what was seen in my trials. You could see that the treatments all grew like without really any significant difference except for the calcium treatments. The calcium treatments were shorter than all the other treatments. And because, again, like previously stated, it stunts the growth. It doesn't it hurts the plants because there's no phosphorus. And here we also saw some genotypic differences. The Cherokee green grew taller than the Japanese black trifle did in the treatment with 15 millimolar phosphorus. And you can see that in the photo with the left picture being the Cherokee green, the right being the Japanese black trifle one. It's a little taller, a little shorter. And there's also a trend where when plants are exposed to areas of pea starvation, they expand their root-to-shoot ratio. This is because even though phosphorus is incredibly mobile within the plant, it is incredibly immobile in the soil. So roots have to expand to exploit a greater volume of the soil because they need to go to the phosphorus. Phosphorus will not come to them. And that's pretty much what we saw, too, especially with the Cherokee green tomato. And you can see that in the photo, the left photo being the Cherokee green, right being Japanese black trifle, you can see the prolific root system of the Cherokee green and the not-so-prolific root system of the other tomato. And you can see that genetic difference, or the genotypic difference, pardon, in this little green square. So what does this all mean? Well, this pretty much supports the whole idea that plants acidify the rhizosphere to help obtain phosphorus. It shows that adding extra calcium may exacerbate these issues evolved with, like, the stunted growth response, which may contribute to plants accumulating much less biomass, which was what was seen experimentally. We saw that the Cherokee green genotype performed better than the Japanese black trifle in regards to the treatments with extra calcium. This shows genotypic difference, which is very important to consider with plant breeding, because we should be able to look towards ways to adapt plants to grow in areas with low phosphorus. And ultimately, we saw that this artificial soil solution was indeed suitable for identifying phosphorus-efficient tomato genotypes. Now, there are many ways to improve this project, and I plan to do just that. In the future, I'm looking for ways to screen wild-type genotypes. This way, it brings in much more genetic diversity, because the ones that I studied in this presentation are commercially available. So I would like to study those in addition to this. I would also like to test other factors that affect phosphorus availability, such as nitrogen source and artificial water stress, like adding it with like PEG, polyethylene glycol. I would like to thank Dr. Liu, my advisor, my committee members, Drs. Cleo Breza and Simone, and Drs. Rathana Savapathy and Shahid for helping me along this journey, as well as UF for providing me the means to study what I love and my references for those interested. But yeah, thanks. Whoops. Sorry, I practice a lot slower, but whatever.
No, you ran out of time.
Okay.
That's great.
Yeah.
So why did you choose those two varieties?
So previous research from people in my lab studied a whole bunch of different commercially available varieties, and they found that Cherokee green was one of the more efficient ones, and the Japanese black trifle was one of the less efficient varieties, and I wanted to explore more into those two. Oh, really? Thank you. I'm not actually sure if that research was in hydroponics or in the field. It was? Okay.
Yours was really small and seemed kind of
controlled. It was very small.
Easy to reproduce, which is a nice way to ask
it. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate
it. Can you still test
it
in the field then?
I would ideally like to test it in the field. I know that one of the reasons why I did in the hydroponics too is because of like time constraints. So,
No, that was great. That was cool.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. Make me smile. Okay.
Everyone else's questions are being
is there anything else?
One thing I forgot to ask everybody is to repeat the questions, but we're too late.
Oh, my bad.
But what were those green plugs?
They're just foam.
Just foam.
Yeah, it was
pretty cool.
Yeah.
It fit like that.
I know, it really works out well in there. So, yeah. Yeah?
So you mentioned that the plugs and then the opaque containers. Why didn't you
want to
get any light in there?
So the question was, why did I not want light in there? So it's like just nutrient solution. It's perfect for like algae to grow, and then you wouldn't like it to be in like liquid instead of like green muck. Is the idea?
Did you put hydrogen peroxide in there? Mm-hmm. Is that oxygenate the water somehow?
It does.
Huh.
Yeah. So I got a little dissolved oxygen meter and measured it. When it was low, I would be like, a little hydrogen peroxide.
Did you ever measure the solution over time? So you made
what do you mean?
And then did you, like, 16 days later see if what the phosphorus?
Oh, I see what you're saying. That is what I will do. I did not have enough time to do that for this presentation. But, yes. I have looked in the literature, not too much with nitrogen source because I haven't really studied that yet.